on FM, online, and on TuneIn 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
And this is Mars Month here on The Space Show. Now, we've had Oscar Castellino on several shows already in this series. And here he is again with the Mars anthem, Rise to Mars. And this time he's with the Royal Welsh Sinfonia. They're from the United Kingdom. And it's for the Mars Society. The lyrics were written by Oscar Castellino and Robert Zubrin, who is going to be on the show in just a few minutes' time. So here we go with the Mars theme.
And next, we have the world premiere of the Mars anthem with baritone soloist Oscar Castellino, performed by the Repco Sinfonia with Andrew Thompson with the baton.
Rise to Mars, men and women, dare to dream, dare to strive. Build a home for our children, make this desert come alive. There are challenges before our eyes that nature never knew, but the power of strife, for our future lies beyond the skies. Rise to Mars, men and women, dare to dream, dare to strive. Build a home for our children, make this desert come alive. Come along, all together,
and that performance was in 2017 in Wales, of all places. Yes, Wales, wonderful country. Now, Robert Zubrin, he is the president of Pioneer Astronautics in Lakewood, Colorado, and he's also one of the big movers and shakers in the Mars Society. He spoke in 2015 at RMIT University, and he allowed us to record his talk. The feed is off a radio microphone that he was wearing, but unfortunately, the RMIT technician left on the lectern microphone, which not only captured the ambient sound, but also Zubrin whenever he was near the lectern. So the sound on this recording is a little variable, but here we go, Robert Zubrin with his ideas on how to get to Mars.
Now, we are going to be on Mars for a year and a half, because that's the time you got to be there for the planets to move around and give you your six-month launch window back to Earth. If you're going to spend a year in transit, it makes sense to be on Mars about a year. That is 6 months each way. You want to spend at least a comparable amount of time on the planet, and as it turns out, you're going to be away 2.5 years, and this lets you spend 60% of that time doing productive exploration, which is the right thing to do. Now, what are you going to do on Mars for a year and a half? You're going to explore. You can explore for all sorts of reasons, geology, you know, particles and fields, weather, so forth. And this is all great stuff. There are various professors that will be able to get tenure by writing papers about this data. But and then put their kids through college and have successful lives. But aside from that, there are two sets of scientific questions that make Mars of interest not just to academic scientists seeking opportunities for publication, but to humanity at large. And the first set of questions revolve around the issues of, was there or is there life on Mars? Mars is cold and dry today, but this was not always so. Mars was once a warm and wet planet. This is an actual photograph of Mars taken by Viking in 1976, and you can see very clearly the water erosion features on the surface of Mars. There's massive numbers of water erosion features visible all over Mars, and there's dried up lakes, ponds, even a dried up northern ocean. Mars once had an ocean, as well as rivers and lakes and all of this. And the evidence is extremely strong that Mars had active liquid water on its surface for a period of a billion years in the planet's early history, which is five times as long as it took life to appear on Earth after there was liquid water here. So, if the general theory is correct, that life is a natural phenomenon that emerges from chemistry wherever you have appropriate physical and chemical conditions, then life should have appeared on Mars, even if it subsequently went extinct when conditions on the surface of the planet deteriorated. And if we can go to Mars and go rock hounding around and find some fossils left by life from this period, which are probably microbial life. In fact, one reason why we want to build a Mars research station here in Australia is in Australia you have fossils left by some of the oldest life on Earth by colonies of bacteria create a fossil mineral called stromatolites, and we want to practice looking for them because that is the most likely sort of fossil you might find on Mars based on what we know. Anyway, you find that, you'll have proven that the emergence of life from chemistry is a general phenomenon in the universe. Okay? And since we now know that planets are more the rule than the exception, the Kepler telescope has shown us probably the majority of stars have planets. It's not one in a million, it's not one in 10, it's probably 8 or 9 in 10 stars have planets. Since every star has a habitable zone, near or far, dependent on the brightness of the star, where you have the right temperatures for liquid water, if you get life developing from chemistry wherever you have a decent planet, it means life's everywhere. Okay? And since we know that the history of life on Earth is one of development from simpler forms to more complex forms, manifesting ever greater capacities for activity and intelligence and ever more rapid evolution, if life is everywhere, it means intelligent life is almost everywhere. It means we're living in an inhabited universe. This is something that thinking men and women have wondered about for thousands of years. Furthermore, if we can go to Mars and drill and get down into the water table, and there is a liquid water table on Mars, if we can get down into it and bring up some of that water. See, if there's life on Mars today, that's where it is. It's not on Mars, it's in Mars. The majority of life on Earth is actually in the Earth. It's underground, and that's because most of the Earth is underground, actually. But, and it's the same with Mars, okay? That's where there's liquid water. That is what the place is habitable on Mars by microbes. We could bring it up. We could look at them and see if they have the same biochemical structure as Earth life. All Earth life has the same biochemical structure. All use the same amino acids, RNA, DNA, a very idiosyncratic method of transmitting information from one generation to the next. That's what life on Earth all is. Mushrooms, people, bacteria, crocodiles, is all the same stuff. Is that what life is, or is that just one particular example drawn from a much vaster tapestry of possibilities? This is what we'd find out by going to Mars and exploring. And this kind of exploration is way, way, way beyond the ability of robotic rovers. Okay, it's just no possibility. So we explore for a year and a half. The end of a year and a half, okay, it's time to nick off. Right. So we get in the Earth return vehicle, we start her up, whew, you take off, go back to Earth. We leave behind the habitat, the reactor, the greenhouse, the vehicles, the solar panels. Is that bad, leaving all this stuff behind on Mars? Very expensive stuff. Shouldn't we bring it back to Earth? No. We have a lot of stuff here already. The idea of Mars missions is to bring as much stuff to Mars as you can and come back with as little as you can, because everything you leave behind on Mars is available to future explorers. So here is the situation we might have on Mars after a number of missions have occurred. This is a map of Mars. Texas is there for scale. You can see Mars is much, much bigger than Texas. Anyway, the centers of these circles are where the landings might be. And if you're stuck in a boring place like this, you could drive to this one or this one or this one or this one and keep exploring on a continental scale. But after a number of missions like this have occurred, we'll know the answer to whether there was life on Mars and what its characteristic forms were. Or if it's a negative answer, we'll have a fair degree of confidence that in that negative answer. And at that point, the situation is going to shift. We're going to move to a new question about Mars. And the new question, the bigger question, is not was there, is there life on Mars? It's will there be life on Mars? Because the most important thing to know about Mars is this. Mars is not just an object of scientific inquiry. It's a world. It's a planet with a surface area equal to all the continents of the Earth put together, and that has on it all the resources needed to support life and therefore technological civilization. And if we can go to Mars and learn how to use those resources, then we can make Mars habitable. Now, what do I mean by make Mars habitable? Do I mean transform the planet? You know, like in Star Trek II, the Wrath of Khan at the end, where they take this barren planet and they transform it into this wonderful living planet covered with pharos and meadows and butterflies and chipmunks and flying fish. Yes. That is exactly what I mean. And I believe that humans will do that with Mars someday. And the reason why I have faith that humans will do that with Mars someday is because we are life, and it is the nature of life to take barren environments and transform them into those that are friendly for the development and propagation of life. That, in a nutshell, is the history of life on Earth. That's how it operates. Life has radically transformed the Earth in the interests of life. It is life that put oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere. Free oxygen was not on Earth before life put it there. Okay? It's life that has created the soil on the continents. Okay, and symbiotic communities of plants and animals have moved off the sea, onto the seashore, up the plains, up the hills, up the mountains, as high up as life can go, it goes. And no sooner does any dead place appear on the surface of the Earth than life transforms it to be a place where life can develop. I mean, think of Polynesian islands coming out of the Pacific Ocean, you know, initially completely dead. Then birds fly over, they drop seeds, the place becomes lush, Polynesians show up, they let loose pigs so there's something good to eat, Europeans show up, build some nice hotels so there's a place to check in. This is what we do, this is the process. And it would be unnatural if humans, as the kind of bird, as it were, that the biosphere has evolved that is capable of transporting life across the ocean of space to barren islands out there, did not do exactly that. So we're going to do that someday. But that's not what we are going to do here in this room. Okay, that's a little beyond our time. Nevertheless, we can have the honor of transforming Mars, of making it habitable, transforming it in a different sense, not so much physically as intellectually. Because you see, the thing that defines, that determines whether an environment is habitable or not, is not just a function of the objective character of the environment itself. It's also a function of you, of what you have in your mind. Okay? Look, two people could be stranded in a wilderness, and one could starve to death in 3 weeks, and the other could live there indefinitely in relative comfort. Why? Because to one, the resources of that wilderness are invisible, and to the other, they are apparent. Okay? And it's the same with Mars. If we can go to Mars and develop the craft of living on Mars, if we can make use of Martian resources, turn them into resources, for example, extract water from the soil so we don't have to bring hydrogen anymore, or better yet, geothermally heated water from the deep subsurface would both give us water and power Okay, we can make ceramics, glasses, plastics, metals, wires, tubes, habitation structures. If we can move up this ladder of craft to become ever more self-sufficient on Mars, then at a certain point, Mars becomes habitable, becomes a place where new branches of human civilization can take root, grow, develop, okay, and become ever more potent in industrial capability, in technological capabilities, in size, until in the fullness of time they become strong enough that they can actually address the question of physically terraforming Mars. Okay, so, and therefore, at the end of this, we don't just bring life to Mars, we bring Mars to life. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Speaking at RMIT University, that was Robert Zubrin, the president of Pioneer Astronautics. He lives in Lakewood, Colorado, and is one of the big movers and shakers in the Mars Society.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Now, mention was made by Robert Zubrin of Robert Heinlein. He imagined the first manned journey to Mars, and he wrote a book, Stranger in a Strange Land. Well, this extract from the book is read for us by Christopher Hurt.
Latin veteran at 30 of the moon run had an inside track at the Institute, someone who looked up for him names of single female volunteers who might, with him, complete a crew, then paired his name with these to run problems through the machines to determine whether a combination would be acceptable. This resulted in his jetting to Australia and proposing marriage to Dr. Winifred Coburn, a spinster 9 years his senior. Lights blinked, cards popped out, a crew had been found. Captain Michael Brandt, commanding. Pilot, astrogator, relief cook, relief photographer, rocketry engineer. Dr. Winifred Coburn Brandt, 41, semantician, practical nurse, stores officer, historian. Mr. Francis X. Seney, 28, executive officer, second pilot, astrogator, astrophysicist, photographer. Dr. Olga Kovalik-Sini, 29, cook, biochemist, hydroponicist. Dr. Ward Smith, 45, physician and surgeon, biologist. Dr. Mary Jane Lyle Smith, 26, atomics engineer, electronics and power technician. Mr. Sergei Rimsky, 35, electronics engineer, chemical engineer, practical machinist and instrumentation man, cryologist. Mrs. Eleonora Alvarez Rimsky, 32, geologist and selenologist, hydroponicist. The crew had all needed skills, some having been acquired by intensive coaching during the weeks before blastoff. More important, they were mutually compatible. The envoy departed. During the first weeks, her reports were picked up by private listeners. As signals became fainter, they were relayed by Earth's radio satellites. The crew seemed healthy and happy. Ringworm was the worst that Dr. Smith had to cope with. The crew adapted to freefall, and anti-nausea drugs were not needed after the first week. If Captain Brandt had disciplinary problems, he did not report them. The envoy achieved a parking orbit inside the orbit of Phobos and spent 2 weeks in photographic survey. Then Captain Brandt radioed, "We will land at 1200 tomorrow GST, just south of Lake Solai." No further message was received.
Okay. So what happened to them? Well, you need to read Robert Heinlein's book, Stranger in a Strange Land, to find out. Now, Elaine Walker thinks it is time for humans to go to Mars. And she thinks it's now, not later. That's her opinion. So let's hear from Elaine Walker with Red Dreams.
Blood red, a drop in a black, black sky. It chills my waking dreams. Metal I have touched has touched its land. Now my soul is there. I am a pioneer and I crave the frontier. Waking to struggles, sleeping to exhaustion. Red land. The distant land that calls my name. It's time, time to go. Now, not later. To Mars, home of my children's children. It's time, time to go.
On next week's The Space Show, we will have more about Mars, including, yes, Robert Zubrin answering audience questions from the RMIT University. Well, this has been The Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie.